Southwest Fire Academy was established in 2015 as a response to the recognized need for quality, safe, and affordable fire and rescue training in Ontario. This is not your average fire college. SFA has high standards for their students, and it is their mission to teach and produce qualified, ambitious firefighters who are prepared to work hard to serve their communities. This is not a diploma mill. This is where you can learn strategic, aggressive firefighting from passionate, intelligent instructors who never forget why they were made to do this job. SFA is an accredited private career college that is regulated by the Ministry of Training, colleges, and universities, with a memorandum of understanding with the Office of the Fire Marshal. This means that SFA is an approved training provider with the OFM, and the programs are recognized in Ontario. Check out the pre-service and expanding selection of course offerings at southwestfireacademy.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 85 of Multiple Calls. I'm Scott Hewlett. It's a strange thing to be trained for and keep training for incidents that you may never find yourself called on to perform in. It's even stranger to not want bad things to happen to people, yet hope that there will be opportunities that test your mettle. Moments that sometimes have an equal chance of leaving you feeling gratified or horrified, or both. With groups of people that in their hearts truly don't know if they can measure up to what might come. Yet here we are, banded together in the brief time we each have to try. Hopefully for what the job offers beyond the material and tangible. The experiences and emotions that are available if we are open to them. Confidence and doubt. Joy and sadness. Excitement and fear. Comfort and suffering. Satisfaction and frustration. Hope and despair. The things that a lived life are made of. Here's my second chat with Nathan Pocock.
Why don't you just update me on where you're at in your new position, and let's go from there.
Back in Isuk, where it all began for me, I was a volunteer here when it first all started. Back in 2008, I started here as a volunteer. I was the first person to get their 1001 through the department with this department back then. Got hired in Vancouver. I got my 1001 in the August and applied to Vancouver in September and started with Vancouver the next April. So I was quickly out the door after getting my 1001 done. And they just posted to hire their first paid chief back here. And it seems like a good homecoming. They're still my original training officer I had when I was here is still here. The old chief that had just retired before I started volunteering, but was still around quite a bit. He's back here just sort of as a support tender driver, help around. I was there here every Sunday helping build our training center and facility. So I was out there with them this morning, and kind of cool to be back around those old faces and back where it is. Brand new hall, totally different hall than what we were in before. It was literally a hall that was built by guys like the two guys I was hanging out with this morning. And now we're in this massive 6-bay hall, which is a pretty big change. Otherwise, a lot of similar faces.
And what runs out of there?
We've got two engines, two tenders, and like a small squad kind of bush truck. And we run a command vehicle, and then we have two trailers. But we're probably going to be phasing out the trailers for a rehab/support truck rather than trailers. It's easier to teach somebody to drive a fire truck than just to pull a trailer. It's just the reality of that situation. Yeah. Sure. But our old tender is actually one of the tenders I first started to drive on when I first started learning how to drive. It's a great little truck. It's got a better turning radius than my F-350. We're thinking about just ripping the tank off the back and putting a big sort of walk-in box on the back.
One of the questions I wanted to start off with you, since you've done a lot of training of firefighters, specifically and especially RIT training, I really wanted to talk about what you think, because I know there's probably a lot of training officers, captains, people just invested in trying to figure out what to offer their firefighters as training. We can stay with RIT or you can expand to other subjects as well, but I was wondering what you thought had the highest value of transfer of skill and information. Maybe let's start with Rit. Like, what have you seen from training in as realistic way as possible transfer best from that setting to the fire ground?
In terms of Rit, I'd say it's kind of hard in a lot of ways to transfer to the fire ground, because it's one of those ones that hopefully never does transfer to the fire ground. One part about Rit I like, and we usually talk about, is, and we try to do, is many of the things we do in Rit, minus when we're doing air supplies and stuff, is just firefighting on steroids. It is the worst case scenario. It is your everyday fire, but something's gone wrong and intensified it that much more. You still may have to extinguish fire if your intervention is heat, right? The three things that kill us: asphyxiation, trauma, and heat. Trauma, we don't really have an intervention except for extrication, but that's one thing we always kind of can get caught up in. Rit is, we sometimes get caught up thinking it's all about just how quickly can we remove them from the building, but it's actually how quickly can we intervene in the problem. If they've run out of air, it's not about getting them out, it's about getting them air. If they're burning, it's not about getting them out, it's about stopping the burning. I mean, we look at the car incident that Glendale County, that was online, and the Sacramento close call, both amazing videos those two fire departments put out about some close calls, both through the floors, second leading cause of mayday. And one of the takeaways I always point to that about on the that intervention piece versus extrication piece is, when they're interviewing the members that went through the floor, this is weeks, months after this incident, and you can even see in the interview their immediate relaxation when they describe when somebody started putting water down the hole. They start describing feeling like, though, from the car incident, the one gentleman describes just being like, I knew I could just stay there. And the same thing that the young guy from Sacramento, I can't remember his exact words, but it was almost just like, oh man, it just felt so good to finally just get hit with that water. Just felt so good. It wasn't them getting relaxed and everything when they described being dragged through the front door. It was when the heat stopped. And that involves rapid deployment to line. That involves rapid search. That involves all the things we do on a regular fire ground, our drags and our carries. Yeah, sure, we got to do pack conversions, everything else. We look at the Fairfax study. We look at the Asheville study. Packaging is hugely important for successful rescue from a mayday situation, but we can still do a lot of similar drags. We can still do a lot of the similar deployments of hose, deployments of ladders. It better be in a hurry. It's a known rescue now. We plan for all these rescues of civilians, but it's an unknown most of the time. We're there to prove that there is nobody in the structure, right? We talk about all these great guys in the fire service all over, and we have the rescue survey and Justin McWilliams and these guys, and they're teaching so much great stuff, and they'll be the first ones to tell you, like, yeah, don't listen to the person on the front lawn. I don't let the person say everybody's out and I take that as gospel. What do they know? I wouldn't let them tell me how to tear apart a car. They're not experienced. They're not professionals. They're not trained to deal with these high intensity, stressful situations. So why are you taking their word for anything? And why should that change our tactics? Right? That whole searchable space versus survivable space.
Do you teach your guys, you're talking about hierarchy of decision-making and problem removal, do you teach your guys to assess for VSA, where then the priority would be removal immediately without packaging, without an air swap?
VSA vitals, you mean?
Yeah, I mean to assess for a downed firefighter if they're VSA or not, right? How you would be able to know if they're VSA when you find them. So then doing the whole pack conversion, well, the pack conversion probably has to happen to move them, but I'm saying like a mass swap, a reg swap, worried about air. When they're VSA and what they need is a defibrillator and they need a hospital.
Yeah, then you got to get them out quick. Yeah, we teach an assessment with, we use the acronym ISABC, so it kind of follows a similar mode to your FR, but essentially identify, make sure it's actually the person you're looking for so you're not on a different firefighter. I mean, you look to that San Antonio line of duty death when they thought they had found the second member, it actually turned out to be a member from Platform 11, not Ladder 35, who had 5 minutes ago was in as part of the RIT team. And they pulled him out, canceled the Mayday, said it was all done, just to realize, oh, shoot, wrong person, right? And there was a whole lot more to that. It seems to be injustice to even mention it without going into the full thing, but very easily done in the situation they were dealing with. But then we do silence the pass alarm, because nobody wants to listen to that, and listen for other pass alarms. Radio communication can be better and everything else. Then the A is air. Your hand's already on the gauge from silencing. Check that regulator. If there's air in the tank, it's immediately a facepiece swap. Try and pick their nose, we say, like with the Scots. You want to make sure the reg's in. And then actually grab the facepiece and deliberately break the seal with your ear close to the head. Because if you got an air leak, then you know the air in the bottle is making it to the mask. If there's no air leak, then there's a problem between the bottle and the facepiece. And now we need, and just like your first aid, we find a problem when we need to intervene, right? And then we carry on. Our B is breathing. Are they breathing? Are they awake? Can they talk to us? Can they help us? And then C being conversion. How are you going to package them?
So for you, at the point of cracking the mask and you know that air is getting from the bottle to the mask, you know their reg is in, they have a seal, you don't hear the reg, you don't hear them breathing because you would hear the reg. Would that for you be the moment where you're like, they're VSA and this is a quick removal?
Yeah, you got to start moving, right? Yeah, we're what if and everything, but depending on how far away they are, you're probably still going to want a package for that removal, right? Amazing how far 10 feet can become dragging a limp firefighter.
Yeah, the pack conversion for sure, but maybe not spending time on the air.
Yeah, if they're not breathing. Thankfully, I've never been in that situation, but I always think about when the adrenaline's hit and you're in that moment, what can you train yourself to realistically recognize? Are they breathing or are they breathing shallow, right? Maybe they're just breathing too shallow to open that reg well. But they've still got breath. I don't know. I'd be curious, actually. Now you got my brain turning.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was a good thing just to bring up between the two of us. The way I've approached it is with CAB, when we check for VSA patients, when we come in, the circulation's broken down for us into RCMP, which is easy to remember for Canadians. And that's respirations, color, movement, pulse, right? With pulse, you obviously can't check that because you have gear on, they have gear on. With color, if you're in low vis, you're obviously not going to be able to see if they're pale or whatever. So now you're down to respirations and movement. So if they're not moving and you don't hear the reg and you don't hear them choking and coughing, then to me, it would be safe to assume that they would be VSA. So doing a full mask swap or taking too much time with that would seem to be a waste of time. So without going too far down the rabbit hole of details of what-ifing things, like you said, I'm trying to actually peel it back to something extremely simple, as in, are they VSA, are they not? And then it being a decision maker off the hop.
Yeah, makes sense, right? I say, right, it's that intervention. So if trauma is the cause, and I mean, the Mayday itself is going to provide you some of that detail too, right? Was it a structural collapse? Was it a medical incident? Did they just drop on the line next to one of their partners?
Which is the highest majority of downed firefighters is cardiac arrest, right?
Still 44%, non-injury deaths, heart attack.
It's not too outlandish to think about a cardiac arrest, VSA, being what you're finding, especially in the absence of a major fire event or a structural collapse or something more, not to say it's more or less dramatic, but more obvious, let's put it that way.
Yeah, more obvious cause. I mean, and that's what ties into our numbers from Don Abbott and his Project Mayday. Is we look at that, like 88% of rescues are from inside, right? 36% self-rescue and 24% are from the Mayday firefighters crew, right? So me and you are in the fire and I fall into that 44% because I freaking love chocolate bars. Down I go. You're the one taking me out, right? RIT's going to meet you at the door, or maybe we're fire attack and RIT takes over fire attack so we can boogie out of there. What likely it's you dragging me out, not somebody else.
Do you differentiate for the people you're passing information on to when a Mayday's action to occur versus a bailout? Is it fair to say with bailouts, you're not often going to get Maydays, right?
Yeah, not if it's an immediate, if they're calling the Mayday once they're on the ground, not when they're before they jump.
Right. If you're in a room and there's an extreme shift or a fire event, you're suffering. Again, I think it's fair to offer that perspective to people that we're not going to hear maydays. We're going to just have people trying to get the hell out of the space.
Well, and you also have to go to the stats, and I can't remember them well off the top of my head, but it's definitely over 20%, but I'm pretty sure it's over 30% of maydays are missed on portable radios the first time they're called. And there's a huge chunk, and Ron Burgess has this stat. I know he does. There's a huge chunk that are actually even missed by dispatch the first time they're called out. So you factor that in as well. If you're in a room that's flashed over waiting to go out a window and you're calling a mayday, I mean, a third of the time, you have to say it 3-4 times before somebody acknowledges it before you can get out that window. So it's probably going to be something else.
It's easy to think about it when you're not suffering, is my point. You're not going to be reaching for your radio. So where that then leads us to is the need to ladder as many windows as possible, because you don't know what window bailouts are going to happen from.
Exactly. Or start investing properly as departments into bailout systems for our members.
In that case, if there's two or three people in the room, can each person stand and set up their bailout system before they jump out?
Well, yeah, it depends on the system, right? If it's integral harness and hook, they don't have any setup time at all. Just pull the hook and go. It would be just as fast as taking turns out on a ladder. Yeah, if they've got to tie something off somewhere, then that's definitely going to add the time.
Do you find that's one of the major struggles when passing and, again, placing things in context, trying to open people's minds to, especially if they haven't had the opportunity to be in the situation themselves, it's really hard to impart what the situation is going to be like. Maybe even the instructors. I mean, how many instructors can say they've been in a RIT situation? A lot of us, and with many skills in firefighting, I think it's worth the discussion that not all of us that are passing on information have actually been in the situation. But what we're doing is we're trying to pass information down the line from the people that have actually been in this situation. We know that it's legitimate training and knowledge to pass on, so we do so.
I'd say where I run into that the most, and I gently correct people, is one of the stations we do is getting up and out of a basement window, 5'10" sill, and teaching people to self-rescue out of that. We show them a bunch of different techniques, and there's one with just a piece of webbing. And that, for a lot of people, is a very challenging skill. And I don't know how many times I hear from students as they're struggling through that and haven't succeeded yet, "Oh yeah, but if there was a fire behind me, I would have enough adrenaline to get up and out." And it's like, no, if there was a fire behind you, this wouldn't be ambient temperatures where you're getting to have a nice, easy, relaxing breath and a water between tries. You're going to be bagged and tired and exhausted, and this is actually going to be 100 times harder than it is right now. It's not going to be easier. It's going to be harder with a fire licking up you. Like, and I think that's one of the things I find in that imparting piece is a lot of the time is like, no, adrenaline's not going to make it better for you in this situation. You're going to be bagged. It's going to be harder in the situation, not easier. That's why we're doing it here, and we're getting efficient at it here. And you're going to do it 10 times now here, because you just need to do it once the time you're going to need it, but you got to do it.
Right. And then every skill is an opportunity to realize, are you as capable as you think you are? And if you're not as capable as you think you are, or that specific technique isn't for you, so you have to adapt. And so it's figuring your own body out. It's figuring your own skill out. Seeing if you can't do it perfectly in training scenario, you're right. You're not going to do it perfectly. If you can reach 70% or 80% of what you've practiced perfectly in training, I mean, that's a huge win.
Yeah, and that's another thing we talk about. I talk about a lot with my students too, is you've got to stop looking for techniques. Comfort for you, comfort for the patient. That's not the goal. The goal is efficiency and speed. If it's uncomfortable for you as a rescuer, who the hell cares if it's going to get that person the intervention happening or that person rescued 10 seconds faster and it sucks for you? So what? That's your job. I'm not going to spend an extra minute to do the fancy window cut down and stuff like that because then I have an easier time. No, but in the same conversation, you have to recognize when I get in, why I train on these things so much is so that I can recognize when the quicker, uncomfortable way isn't going to work. And the window cut down is actually the fastest way to get this person out in that situation, right? It is a tool but it's not the go-to tool. And somebody's got to be inside already anyway. So get in there, try it by yourself. If you can't get them out, then recognize what you need, whether it's a ladder high point, a second person, a window cut down, because then those do become the fastest thing, but that shouldn't be your go-to thing based on the comfort and ease of it.
Do you talk about victim size or even firefighter, right? Even down firefighter or victim just in general. Do you talk about victim size at all? So when there are people, and if think of people open their eyes more and look around just in their daily life, they're going to realize that they probably couldn't lift many people up and out a window. Even two firefighters couldn't do it. And then B, could you actually bring them down a ground ladder? You talk about victim size and protect in place, remove the problem as well.
Yeah. And that's part of that caveat of, especially in volunteer and POC fire services, when you're dealing with those people is again, it's training enough to recognize that it's different for all of us. For some people out there, 120-pound patient is their threshold. For some people, it's a 250-pound patient. And they are responsible for knowing that threshold to trigger moving up in the next rescue technique, right? And they're only going to get that with practice. And how many places do you go where the dummy's 120 pounds? I know I've got my dummy I made myself because I just can't stand the dummies that you buy on the market because they're not realistic. And it's 185 pounds, which realistically is light.
Very.
Right? And how many people will complain about the weight of it? And then you go look at their dummy, it's a 120 pound dummy.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to hone in on here is the training scar of if we're always even just training on removing each other from a window, one or both people are usually on belay and tied off so they can't fall. And B, the ladder is usually fully secure. And then we're only training with people that are, like you were saying, comfortable for us or an average size. And many of those probably won't be true in, even when you listen to the Grabs podcast quite a bit, right? And realistic rescues and how difficult it is to even move smaller patients. So yeah, I guess I just wanted us to have this conversation just to put it out there and have people's perspective open up a bit about, yeah, how are we training and what are we thinking? What is the fantasy that we're creating in our heads versus what's actually going to happen?
It's amazing how much Hollywood still has an effect even on us in the profession. It's like your patient's not going to have six-pack abs and be fully dressed. That's just not how it goes. That's it's just not, right? And we almost train like that. We buy the light dummy. We put them in turnout gear where I can easily grab the coat and haul that around. Well, anybody else, if they even have a shirt on, the shirt's going to rip. You try and move them like that.
Yeah, and I've heard, I think Justin, like you mentioned, and a bunch of other guys in that level that he's at, they'll put protective sort of helmets and like elbow pads and knee pads on and then like grease down their arms and legs and then get firefighters to try and move them, right? Like those guys are really pushing the envelope of making it as realistic as possible, which I think is huge value.
Yeah, they're doing some pretty cool stuff. I just admire anybody willing to go into that part of the fire service, any part of the fire service with that kind of detail, right? And we need that. The day of the stupid firefighter is long gone, or at least I hope it is. I don't know how many times I heard that early on in my career. It's like, oh, well, we're just dumb firefighters. And I'm like, it just doesn't seem like a great sales pitch. Like, you know, I just feel like we shouldn't accept that. But in the same token, we'll talk about how we need to know so much. And we do. And I'm so grateful for all these guys that dive into these topics like they do, because there's too many of them to be able to reach out to a guy like Andy Stearns when you got a tick question, to be able to reach out to guys like Justin or Cody when you want to talk about grabs and things like that. Like, there's just so many, Sean at Rise Above, if you want to talk about tools, like that, it is so great. We have these people that have picked a part of the fire service that and become true experts in it. That's awesome. Even like trench rescue, I mean, I remember reaching out to Greg. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, so I'm scared to say it online here, but he's down in Michigan and he does all sorts of stuff and just fantastic knowledge on anything paratech or trench rescue, machine rescue. He does some really cool stuff. And when I had that trench call, he was such a valuable resource for me after that call, because nobody could answer my questions I had anywhere nearby. And he was on the phone with me. He put me in touch with Army Corps engineers from the U.S. military. And we went through the call step by step, diagram by diagram, because there was stuff that happened in that call that I'd never been trained on. And I hated that. That is the worst feeling in the freaking world, to encounter something you haven't been prepared or haven't prepared for. That is a disgusting feeling. And what really put me at ease was I ended up chatting with these three Army Corps engineers and Greg, and I think one of them had said like it was 142 years of trench experience in the conference call, and none of them had ever heard of a rescue like that before, where we had to do what we had to do. And just that comment alone just made me like, oh, thank Christ. Like, okay, it was as stressful as it should have been. Like, I can't take that all on as a lack of preparedness.
That's a huge point that you just brought up there, that not only do these subject matter experts have huge value ahead of the call, but they have a huge value post-call to help us break it down. And then, like you said, offer the actual insight to like, listen, man, what you're dealing with was not average. So peace of mind afterwards.
The fire service has got a lot of things that we could do better and work on, but there's also some like things like that that are just so inspiring to me that I just find so cool.
So really, we should be hugely grateful, even within our own department, if we have subject matter experts. They're fast tracking us through having each one of us having to dive down the rabbit hole.
Absolutely. And that was Julio Ramos and down in Florida. I was talking to him, and their rescue crews they run, they do everything, hazmat, like pretty much all 1006. And when I was chatting with him, he was saying that each guy on the rig is kind of dedicated to be the subject matter expert on each shift for one of the topics. They're all trained in it, but everyone's kind of picked. And it's like, man, that makes sense, right? How many times do you head to a rescue crew and they've got the one keen guy that everyone leans on for all the topics? And it's like, well, that's easy for everybody else. So yeah, we got, I don't know, pick a name. We got John over there. John's into this stuff. And you got a question, ask John. Well, have you ever stopped to think about how freaking stressed John is, because he knows he's the one everyone's going to be asking questions to, and he can't ask anybody else because they're all asking him?
Or what happens when John's off, right?
Exactly, right? And what do you do then? To be able to have that divided up like subjects like that, I think it's brilliant. I mean, and I'm sure it doesn't work that smoothly. I'm sure there's anytime humans get involved, it's not going to be perfect, but it's a great concept. I think it divides the work nicely.
And would be even more of a struggle the smaller the department gets.
Absolutely. That was one thing I will say that I didn't fully appreciate when I was a part of it. I did appreciate it, but I appreciate now more that I'm out of Vancouver is the fact that we had those specialties. We had the tech rescue team. We had the hazmat team. And not so much that it wasn't that it was hard. It was easier to get the knowledge, but it allowed us to go further down those holes. Now in the position I'm in now, like, we're running ropes, we're running hazmat, we're running our regular fire stuff, we're doing our EMS, and it's like, you're trying to do that jack of all, right? And so, yeah, no, we're not doing crazy high angle, sloping high lines and stuff like that. We can't do that as well as be pump operators, as well as be hazmat technicians. We're not doing any of that stuff, right? Like, it's like, no, we're basic ropes, low slope, high angle. We're not even touching confined space. We don't have that capacity. Whereas when we were a dedicated rescue team, we were able to tech level everything, structural collapse, confined space, rope, everything. We could just go so far down, and even the equipment we were able to purchase, right? We had a dedicated tandem axle rescue truck. It didn't have hose. It didn't have water on it. It just did rescue. Smaller places like this, we can't afford to dedicate a truck to that.
So are our other departments around you supporting you in those areas where you're lacking?
No, they're all kind of in the same boat. It's a funny area down here in the Capital Regional District. Essentially, from the time you get off the ferry, I don't know how well you know Vancouver Island, but from the ferry to where we are here in the Souk area is about an hour-ish drive. In that hour, you're going to pass 13 or more fire districts. And they are all independent to themselves. even what people generally consider Victoria. Victoria is three halls in a small downtown core. It's actually Saanich and Oak Bay and Esquimalt. And then there's Central Saanich and there's North Saanich and there's Saanich-Tin and then there's Sydney and there's, and it just goes on and on like that forever, right the way out to here. So, and they're all independent of each other. We have mutual aid for our fires and everything. We rely on each other. But when it comes to those things outside of fires, it's not set up yet. And it's been discussed before to try and do that, but people get involved, right? And that people thing is where it becomes imperfect. Our hazmat team is regional down here. We're pretty unique that way. The Capital Regional District does run a regional hazmat team, and all the equipment, all the 13 fire departments in the CRD pay into it. And all the equipment is kept in one Central Saanich's fire hall. And then every department can or does put people into the program to run it. So when a call comes in for a big hazmat call, the people at the department where the truck is will respond in it, and the rest will respond from where they are to that scene to cover regionally that specialty. But we haven't done anything like that with any other specialties. It's only been the hazmat. And it's been going well for the most part for a long time. There's actually a review going right now over that hazmat. So we'll see what comes from that and the service that's had. But it was like that when I was here the first time. So it's been going for well over a decade like that, if not two. So it seems to be working for everybody.
So what are you doing for the confined space call then? If you don't have, I mean, you can't be expect, like you said, you can't be expected to be tech and everything when you're dealing with staffing and logistics with the size of a department. So what are you doing in those cases for those calls?
Yeah. What are we doing? That's, I mean, really.
Well, you're not the only department that's in this boat. So that's why I'm kind of just offering the question up.
I have that training. So, I mean, realistically right now, there would, depending on how complicated it was, but we don't have the equipment. So you'd have to look to find the closest department that did and request a mutual aid, which would be Colwood, I think, which is only two towns over. But that's still the way the geography around here is. I mean, bar one tiny bit strip of land, we're almost an island here. We're out on a big peninsula. So they're half hour away, which it's confined recovery probably by then. If you put in our delay of response to assessing it, to requesting that resource, and we don't have a mutual aid agreement with them. So that's going to put delay on it because the government's going to get involved with a response number. And barring that, you're like having to call Canada Task Force One, which would again need a response number, and they're stationed in Vancouver. So there's a 3-hour response. Welcome to the reality. I mean, you live rural.
Yeah, and this is the struggle with, like I said, many departments and then towns, and that may not necessarily want to, or maybe it's maybe not even just that they don't want to, or they can't, don't have the resources to invest in giving departments every single thing they need for every single rescue, especially when they're looking at probabilities of those calls coming in.
And that's where your regional teams make sense, but they're not the best solution because there's a delay in response in that alone, but it becomes more efficient with funding and can make training realistic because you're not trying to, don't have to try and train up 10 of my members to a confined space ops level and then maintain their confined space ops level. I might only have to have two people that are trained in maintaining that ops level, which that's probably doable, but having 10 people, that is not doable.
Yeah, it's definitely the second piece to training that departments may not always consider is the maintaining. You can bring a lot of programs in, you can bring a lot of equipment in, but and do that train the trainer, and you check the box and you think, okay, we're good, and then you move on to the next flavor of the month. But it's the maintenance of all these skills which is the key.
I get why we do the train the trainer programs, and I don't know the solution to that problem, but that's not the best model. It's not a... Well, maybe it is the best model because I don't know the solution. So maybe it is the best model. So I shouldn't say it isn't the best model, but the way I've seen it in some programs anyways, it definitely doesn't necessarily provide what you're looking for.
Well, isn't it just approached that way because it's the most financially efficient model?
Yeah, probably, right?
Because you just bring the one expert in the one time for $5,000 and they teach everybody, and then you're just paying your people their salaries to teach everyone else. But we, you and I both know, you learn a program once, you don't, you've been exposed to it, you don't know it well enough to teach it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of that box ticking, right?
Yeah. You mentioned when we were talking about what to cover, and maybe this is a nice lead in from what we're talking about here, about do we need like a wholesale change in the fire service model in Canada?
I'm one of those guys, chief can't stand coming to their office pointing out all the problems and not giving any solutions. I'm one of those guys in this situation. But I just find it really interesting culturally how we have as a society, and I don't know how it worked back in the 1800s. Maybe it made sense back then. We will pay $200 for a hockey game and not bat an eyelid at it, but we demand the person responding to our house lights on fire or our loved ones in cardiac arrest to be doing it for free. And it boggles my freaking mind. And that's the general sort of cultural view. And when you put it like that, they would deny it. But the general day-to-day conversation around it, that is what is put across. Well, I don't need to pay more for that. I don't need, and maybe it's a lack of education, and maybe that's partly our fault as a fire service. I think it's also the incredible change that has happened. I know at least here in BC, we've had such a shift in requirements, even in my short time in the service. The amount of paperwork that goes with even just your regular Thursday night practice is gone from almost nothing to there is a good hour or so before and after of prep and paperwork and filing and all that stuff that's now happening. And the Office of the Fire Commissioner has put out their training standards for fire departments. And again, I don't disagree with the standard. The standard's fantastic. I think it's important that we be doing that, but they don't enforce it, for one. There's some paradoxes he's inside that standard. There's three levels of service. There is exterior, interior, and full service. But one of the things you need for interior is your 1407 RIT training. But technically, to have your 1407 RIT training, you already need to have your 1001, but you don't have your 1001 in that program until you're full service. So you have to be full service before you can get your 1407 to then complete your interior. So there's even its own paradox within it. But it all makes sense. You've now said they can go interior, so absolutely they should have RIT training. Like, it's just somebody didn't quite read it all when they put that in. But that's all stuff. I mean, RIT training, that's a 40-hour program. Plus, you have to maintain it, right? You've got your 1001. That's a program. They've now included, again, totally agree with it. They have in there the 1002 stuff that has to be met for driver operators. Totally agree. We can't just let the guy drive me around the block for 2 minutes and say, good, you're a pump operator. No, they need a process. They need to be confident behind that pump. Hydrology is something we as firefighters, that is a huge hole I notice in our system. Well, you just pull this lever and that lever. Yikes. No, we don't. There is so much more to it than that. It's easy to show water. It's not so easy to be a good pump operator. There are two different things. Again, that now adds time. Well, there's another 40-hour program that has to be maintained. And I can't have dedicated drivers because I'm the only career person here. So I don't know who the driver is going to be. Sometimes it's me because the people that respond aren't signed off on driving yet. So guess what? I'm driving. Right? Like, it's just the way it is. On top of that, we have our FR licenses we have to have. Plus, they've mandated, again, totally makes sense. You have to have part of your 1021 and have your safety officer and your officer training in order to be in charge of a scene. I 100% support all these standards, but we've put them all out there without the public realizing what that means and the hours and the cost that goes to all that. Your fire department can't just be $100 of your taxes anymore if you want it to meet these standards. I guess that's an education piece for us in the fire service, but how do you properly educate a community to understand that when there is the reality of how many people do you think in our communities actually call us percentage wise. I mean, that's got to be in the lower two digit numbers. You got to think that we go to, but you've got to convince. So you got to convince at least 51% the need for this stuff to have that passed in a democratic vote. But not even 50% of that 50% has ever needed your services. That's a huge, huge battle for us, I think, as a fire service to have that understood.
And then within the fire department, a perspective piece would be, let's not add any additional programs until we've nailed down these ones that we have to focus on to start with.
I can't remember who said it, but I remember somebody saying something like, don't talk to me about drone programs until I can see you can pull a hose line. And there was that trend for a while. Everyone wanted a drone. And it's like, well, let's just get good at this stuff first. Or there's the staffing level issue. Like, I've only got 12 people at a structure fire. I don't need one of them flying a drone.
Well, I mean, you talked about culturally too. So as they make chief positions more and more difficult to achieve, part of getting hired for these spots is very often, okay, have a vision. What do you want to bring to the department that's new? Again, I said flavor of the day or flavor of the month previously when we were talking about the other topic, but that almost seems to be expected. Or guys want to bring in what they feel their legacy is or what they want to focus on. And when you keep coming into these positions and these fundamentals haven't been taken care of within your department, you're only making it more and more impossible to nail those down when you're burying them in more stuff that needs to be trained and maintained.
Absolutely. And the flavor of the month stuff, I don't know. It seems a growing trend that you don't see chiefs in a department for 10, 12, 20 years anymore. You see them for 3 or 4. And I don't know if it's flavor of the month, because I mean, I know I'm changing things and I think I'm changing them for the better and making the fundamentals more efficient and everything else. That being said, the people below me and in my department might be looking at that as, oh boy, here's his flavor of the month, right?
Well, I think the drones you brought up is a very stark example of what I'm talking about. Not coming into your department trying to restructure to make things more efficient, more effective. I think that's what we're trying to get to, or what we think should be. What I'm saying is, like you pointed out, the drone program would be a very stark, obvious one of like, let's not worry about that right now until we get these other things taken care of. Let's just take a year, maybe two, maybe three. Let's just cycle through these fundamentals and get our whole department on board with that. Get everybody pumping first before we worry about flying drones.
If every house fire we go to, we run out of water or we're sifting through a foundation at the end of it.
The drone will get a great shot of it.
Yeah, we probably don't need to be focused on a drone program.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we've all seen that happen within departments where there's something like that, the drone program, where it's like, here's another one. And then, like you said, if people that are coming in with new innovative ideas to add on to the pile, if they're not going to be there for a significant amount of time, then people just think this will just come and go anyway, so I won't pay attention to it.
Yeah, exactly, right? And you got to think about that. Like, you want to make a change. They say cultural change takes 3 generations. If you're coming in for cultural change, I mean, in a career department, 3 generations is 90 years. That's impossible in one chief's lifetime. So the only way you could possibly make cultural change in a high up position is be able to train and impart that onto the next generation that's going to take over from you. And you're not doing that in 3 or 5 years. So you can't make cultural change as a chief or anyone in a department with influence if you're not there long enough to impart that on the next person to take over. And I get hiring outside because sometimes you don't have qualified people inside, and sometimes you need to hire outside to create a different view and to create some cultural change. But if you hire from outside to create that cultural change, it's not cultural change, it's cultural shock. If they're only there for 3 years, where you go, holy crap, well, that was interesting. That was kind of different than we're used to. Poof, out the door they go. And now somebody else comes in and we're shifting that culture again, even slightly maybe to that new person's thing. Or now we're to somebody internal again, and we're just going to default back to what that person was brought up in for the 30 years prior to them getting that position. And it's an interesting game that has to be played. And it's a big picture that I don't think ever gets looked at. if your goal is change, and politicians probably never look at it either because they live in a life of 4-year terms. They're doing the same game.
So really the expectation of people hiring for chief positions, their expectation should be that someone come in and just like a captain dropping in for the first time into a brand new crew, they get promoted, they get dropped into a crew. If they kick in the door the very first day and start to want to wholesale change the entire crew and how they do business, that's not going to go very well, right? That captain should probably spend some time just seeing how the crew operates over, 2, 3, 5 months, 6 months. Then you'll start to see patterns and you'll start to know people. You start to understand the why, and then you can slowly start to impart some change. Maybe then that needs to be the expectation. Instead of expecting chiefs to come in brand new from outside or from or not and expecting them to impress, I guess, the best thing to do would be to learn how is the team already functioning, right? How is this department already functioning over time? Learn how to keep that running and then slowly shift things. Would that be a better approach?
I think it is, but that's that conundrum where I don't think our system's set up to allow that. I don't think city councils and even fire departments in and of themselves are set up necessarily to allow that.
To allow to understand status quo or so to speak, learn what's in the box before you start to move things outside the box.
Yeah, or give them time.
Well, my one buddy always talked about how he called it the shirt tug. He said, you're going to get in a chief position if you end up in a chief position for anybody. He wasn't saying to me. He says, when you end up in this position, he says, it's all about the shirt tug. Everyone's tugging the shirt. Hey, hey, hey. I noticed it in training that, and again, it's no one's fault, but everyone thinks that their email or their phone call is the only one you're getting that day.
I even tried to impart that on my commission after a weekend. It's not alarming for me to come in and see 80 to 100 emails sitting in my inbox. Everyone has a legitimate concern. It's kind of the fire department in a whole, in a way, is like, who gets called when somebody stubs a toe and it hurts them real bad? Who gets called when their toilet's backed up and they don't know how to use a plunger? I mean, this is a small department, right? And I think that's just part of it. These people are learning that. And I think that's part of my role. I mean, leader's intent, right? You go down to leader's intent. Until leader's intent's established and known, people don't know the box and the parameters to which they make those decisions. And I've got to empower that in some way or form.
So they don't have to come to you with everything.
It's okay to make this decision because you know what I'm going to say and you know the consistency of that answer and what's expected, right? 4.5 months in here. So also, it's interesting, like, I had one of our brand new recruits come in last night. He was using the gym and I'm in the kitchen chopping and cutting and doing all the stuff prepping for, we got a class of 20 here today, prepping for their lunch today. And he's, oh, it looks like you're cooking yourself a big dinner. So this isn't for me. So this is for everybody tomorrow. He goes, Chief, I didn't think you were a caterer. And I was like, yeah, well, no job can be below me. That doesn't work, right? No job is below the chief. The shitters are dirty and there's no one here to clean it. Who am I to say, well, they stayed dirty, somebody else should clean them? No, this is my hall just as much as it is anybody else's. I mean, I have to expect, do I expect somebody to do it if they're here and capable of doing it? Absolutely. But it's not below me to do it. I mean, I'm not so freaking arrogant to think that I can't do that stuff. And I think some chiefs get caught up in that, especially in these smaller department roles, trying to be big department chiefs. And, well, I don't need to go on that call. I don't need to do that. I'm chief. And it's like, why not? If there's a seat open on the truck, get on it. I mean, why wouldn't you? I mean, the value in that, right? Like, one, I just love going on calls.
I was going to say, even selfishly.
Yeah, like, well, yeah, right? Like, even so, I just like going on calls, even if it's a nothing call. But two, how else do I engage in my membership? How else do I know where they're at? How else do I help teach them? Their best teaching moments can be on calls. And there are some moments that aren't teaching moments. There are some moments absolutely are not. We had a call a little while ago and it was an infant respiratory arrest that was going cardiac. And you know what? I went on that call with two of our members and thankfully for them, that was the first time they ever dealt with an infant needing resuscitation, but it wasn't mine. But that wasn't the time for me to go, hey, I need you to do this and I want you to do that. No, I was the first one in putting an OP in and starting bagging and getting AEDs ready. And you know what? We'll talk about this after the fact. But next call was a guy who, for whatever reason, passed out weirdly on a bus. Something had gone wrong. Well, yeah, you know what? I'm not hands-on on this patient. I've got a brand new person that hasn't ever taken vitals before. Guess who's up to take vitals? This is a teachable moment, right? But none of that's happening. Either way, that is supporting your members. And that doesn't happen if you think you're too good to be doing that sort of thing.
And as a leader, you're recognizing what value exists on each call for the patient and for your members.
And to quote Aaron Fields, if we truly are family, work makes family. To quote, and that's Aaron's quote that I really like, is work makes family. And if you're not working with them, then somebody's working for somebody. And are you working for them or are they working for you? A lot better to be working with each other than one or the other. That's my personal take. And yeah, sure, some admin stuff falls behind, but Jesus, if I turn this screen around for you right now, you'll see a whiteboard that's running out of room and it's 5x4. And I'm not writing big. And that's the list of things that need to be done. I'm never going to finish it. So you know what? What's 2 hours on a call? It ain't going to make a difference to that list.
Yeah, it sounds like you're pretty good at that perspective now of, yeah, that's a great perspective. It's never going to get finished, so you just plug away what you can when you can. You'll be passing on a full whiteboard to the next guy, right?
Oh, absolutely. Every time I erase something, actually, I was laughing to myself last night because I managed to erase a few things, but literally in spots where I erased one thing, I filled it in with two. I almost needed to get something done to erase it off the whiteboard so I could cram two more list items onto the board.
And really, if you went day after day, week after week, month after month with nothing on the board, then what are you even doing there? Do you want to sit around and stare at a blank whiteboard all day? Like that's
oh,
not
God, no.
Right. I just think we're maybe touching on the whole idea of like being overwhelmed with so much that you can't even possibly pick one. But the extreme would be nothing, and then somewhere in the middle there is what's sustainable.
Don't get me wrong, there's some days where I look at that board and I'm like, oof, I don't even know where to start, and it's overwhelming. But you just start somewhere. And probably there are some things that I should prioritize over others, but I don't want to do those things, so I just work on something else on the list. I'll be the first to admit that.
That's the human side of things right there. We're not efficient, non-feeling robots, so we have preferences.
There are some things that I look at that list, I'm like, ooh, that really should be done. I've put 3 stars beside it now, but I really just don't want to.
Once it gets to 4 stars.
Yeah, once it gets to 4 stars, we'll be concerned.
How are you approaching officer development? You talked about parting teachable moments and also leadership intent or leader's intent. Again, it's one more program you'd have to roll out. I just want to know your thoughts on sort of how do you approach that within, is it informal? Is it formal? How are you approaching it?
Right now, I mean, in all honesty, it's totally informal. There's nothing at all happening officially with it. It's on the to-do list as something that needs to happen. Right now, I'm focused purely on the firefighter fundamental piece. That is a gap that is on all levels that we're working on. Driver training, we got 7 members in that right now. Really bringing that up with a program I wrote to deliver here to get them to 1002. And the officer development piece is the next piece I want to do after this driver piece is through. Start developing that officer piece and working on it. I have a really good friend who teaches with me as well with Prepare For that is only a few departments over. He said he'll help out and he's been helping out. And I'm leaning on him for some of that. I'm hoping that when the time comes, he's going to be able to help with that officer development piece as well and really help start rolling that out and developing that. Cause it is a big gap. Cause I mean, how long does it take to be good and efficient at what we call the basics and air quotations of firefighting? I mean, Generally, I would say, and just picking random sort of average numbers, in my experience in the POC volunteer world, it's usually about 3 years till you get a person that you're happy to see drive away on a truck and you're not concerned. That's usually when you get to the point that you're like, yeah, they got this. Nothing wild's going to happen with that crew. It is generally at that 3-year-ish mark. Well, the average lifespan of a volunteer in BC is 3 years. So, right? It's this brutal game of attrition where it's just like get them right to where you want them. And for whatever reason, they move, their job changes, they move out of their parents' basement, they get a girlfriend, they move out of district, get a boyfriend. Whatever, they go to university, they get a new job, they get hired on full time. Any number of things can take, or they're just done volunteering, right? They had their time, they did their thing. You know what? This is a lot of work. It's too much for me. I'd rather be on a paddleboard. Okay, right? You're not going to hold it against them for that. You can just be grateful for what they gave, and that's it. Right. So getting to an officer level is definitely tough. Right. You've got to have those people that are the small minority, the ones that last longer than the average. So that your numbers are already really thinned down if you're going to start looking at that. It's interesting. I look at our roster right now, and even being a volunteer department, besides myself, I look at it. It's a huge gap in the middle. You've got those people that are your minorities that have made it past the 3 years and they're 20 years. And then it goes to 3, 2, and 1, make up the bulk of the group. There is no real 8 year, 7 year range people. It is 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, couple of fours, and then you're right up to 17 years. And none of that middle ground. It's you're there. And so it's kind of that missing piece. And those ones that are up top already have had some of that officer stuff. There's definitely some development to do there still. I mean, we can I've got I'm still in school and still learning so much and have people I lean on. So the officer thing's always going to be tough, I think, for us, for anybody in a similar style department.
Do you find that with what's available technology-wise, again, podcasts being an example, YouTube, anything, people aren't living in vacuums anymore, right? Speaking of informal leadership training, a lot of people, a lot of us, right? We may not even be in formal academic settings to be getting leadership training and get the certificate, but a lot of us are listening to a lot of content on leadership from valuable people. Are you seeing that? Are you feeling that? That being out there and filtering into people's brains is helping, where again, your people aren't in a vacuum and you have to provide everything that there is to know about being an officer with a program. It's like we can all come in having heard or understood a lot of this from our own little, you have to be into the job to be listening to that kind of stuff and wanting to be a leader.
Where that would be difficult in a setting like this is that for many of the people you're describing, they work in a firehouse setting and that's what they're doing when they're at the gym or whatever. That's in their free time as part of their hobby piece. But for many of the people here, that time is being here.
Because they're also trying to encompass what they do for their full-time job, right? And they're doing training in that regard, right?
Exactly. They got their Monday to Friday that they've got to train for and pay attention to and are passionate about and everything else. So when they're given 3, 4, 6, 10 hours a week to hear, that is that time for them.
That's a great perspective. That's a reality I think everyone should hear. That's really good.
It's tough. It's a funny balancing game because you are absolutely allowed to have standards for volunteers. Absolutely allowed to have standards and enforce those standards, but you can't demand things. And I think those two get confused. I can't demand people volunteer their time. I can set out standards that state that this many hours need to happen and this many JPRs need to be accomplished in order for you to do this. And if you don't accomplish those things, the standard is you can't do that and you have to do this until you can prove those things. That's absolutely acceptable. But I can't say you have to be here and you have to do this, because they don't. They're not my employee. Because the other option is they just walk away and hand in their paycheck.
Yeah, and so then what is realistic? Just like with a university or a college, and I was just talking to a friend today that's deep into some academics, and you're still in it, so you'd understand too that each professor seems to treat their class like the only class and the only thing you're doing in your life right now. So the volume of work for each class is as much as, you know, it would take you 4 months, but you're taking five of those. So where's this fine line of understanding how much mental real estate and how much actual time people have to achieve the things that we set in front of them? We could tie into even, we talked about bringing specialty programs, and it's like, yeah, that specialty program looks amazing on paper. And if this is the only thing we were doing, we could run it perfectly. But we're running six other programs just like this at the same time. So I think that's a perspective we need to have all the time of what mental real estate, what time do we have to allocate to things?
And not expecting something we don't expect of ourselves. And I kind of look at that too, where I've sort of said to, like, yeah, okay, I get paid to be here, but I also volunteer to be here outside of what I get paid to do, because I can't tell my members to go have a job, but then give me 200 hours a year. So I have a similar expectation to myself. This is my job. This is my Monday to Friday, but you know, I'll volunteer 200 hours a year as well, because you guys are. To think it should be any other way around is, I don't know, arrogant. I don't know what the right word would be, but
it also keeps you aware of what their experience is. So then you have a more realistic expectation to them, because you know how what it is to do it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And when I have my bosses tell me I have to do things, that's definitely, I think, well, no. Right. And that's the same for my members. Is, yeah, ultimately at the end of the day, like, okay, my employer has a little bit more of that leeway on me as my employer, but yeah, I don't have that leeway on these guys. Like I say, I can't demand they do anything. I can ask nicely and I can be extremely grateful for everything they do, but I can't demand anything. Like I say, I can set standards. I can absolutely set standards, and I do. And if you don't meet those standards, then here is your chosen consequences for not meeting the standard. And that's fine. And sometimes it sucks, because extenuating circumstances, you get shipped away for work, there's problems at home, and now you don't meet the standards because of life. And is that awkward when you have to tell somebody, hey, right now, you know, you're not coming to calls until you can bring this up, or hey, right now, you don't get this benefit of being here because you haven't met the standards? Does that suck? Absolutely. But I think it's also just, it's fair.
And I think the people hearing that would respect it. They, I mean, you are an adult and coming in and saying that you're willing to give so many hours. And me volunteering in my community, I struggle with the same thing, with a lot of things going on, and trying to maintain those hours is tough.
And I think everyone gets it. And I think it's just keeping that black and white approach in some ways with that stuff, right? Just so that it can't be seen to, I think when you start making adjustments, oh yeah, well, you know what, you had a problem in your family, so that rule is not going to apply to you, but it still applies to this other person who we might not know the backstory. They just haven't elected to tell us because they're a private person. Well, now Kat gets out of the bag that they actually had the same thing happen. Just who am I to get to know that there was family tragedy? That's none of my business. That's their personal life. They shouldn't have to tell me, right? So, I mean, you kind of got to just treat it all the same regardless of the situation for some of that stuff, right?
Is it Jordan Peterson that was saying, you know, you can't just always assume it's malevolence. You can't always assume it's bad intent. You can't always assume.
Which can be hard for people in our profession.
Well, so then this segues nicely and maybe a great one for us to finish off on, the positive versus the negative. You talked about the other day when you were driving and you're like, whatever happened to the courtesy wave, right? And you were saying how it translates into the fire service of focusing on the negative over the positive. And I love the term toxic positivity, because that is a problem too, where people don't want to talk about anything negative, or everything's good vibes and positive vibes and positivity all the time. That's not realistic. But I mean, the other end of it, to toxic negativity, is an issue too. So maybe just riff on that a little bit for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was just a great way of phrasing it when I had been driving through town that one time. And I remember there was like just a few people I let in, and there was a few people on the crosswalk. It was crosswalk. That was a big one. There's several people I stopped for at the crosswalk, and it was just like they walked almost angrily by. And I was kind of just like, in that moment, like, whatever happened to the courtesy wave, right? Like, and it's something I've always imparted to my kids. Like, that person stopped for you. I mean, yeah, technically they're supposed to, but they also could have just run you over. Like, feels like there should be a wave, right?
Yeah. So even when people have to do something technically, it doesn't mean you can't be like, thanks a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, I always love that too, that like the shopping cart being the greatest litmus test of mankind.
I love that. Yeah.
Like, it's fantastic. Right. And I remember pulling in one town we were teaching in, and up in Northern BC, and it was a Walmart, and there was only like two cars in the parking lot, but we almost couldn't find a parking spot because there was a shopping cart in every single one of them. And it was right after we had had that shopping cart conversation. And I was like, huh, what's that tell you about this place? And it's known as a rough and tumble town, so it was all the more funny. But yeah, that the courtesy wave, like just that simple, like it was a thing we defaulted to thanking people for at one point. You thanked people for the doorway. You opened and held the doorway for people. You did all that stuff that was sort of intrinsically taught through a day-to-day to be grateful for those small things and to give those small things for the appreciation of knowing that it made a little bit of a difference in somebody's life. And all that seems to have gone. And I don't know why. And where it comes into the fire service is the coffee table was such a double-edged sword and is such a double-edged sword. It is the greatest place for laughter and jokes in a fire hall. It's also the greatest place for misery and contempt in a fire hall. Negativity is so freaking powerful. And I used to work with this one guy, and I admire him so much. He's now an assistant chief in Vancouver. His name's Justin Mulcahy. And he was one of the few guys I ever worked with that had the confidence, but also just like sheer good humanness to call people out on that stuff. And they would start down the rabbit hole of ragging on somebody. And he would call them out and be like, what are you on about? I remember one time he even called me out on something that was one of the guys had bought, and I was just in a bitchy mood. I'll be the first to admit it. I was in a bad mood day. One of the guys had spent extra money on eggs, organic, free range, whatever eggs. And I worked and lived, my family still owns a organic free range woodland egg farm in England. I know the game, and it's a game. They're eggs. But my opinion, that's probably gonna enrage a whole bunch of people. But besides the point, right? And he just called me out on it. He's like, dude, shut the hell up. The guy's just trying to buy you good food. It was a great check. I was like, yeah, what am I bitching about? The guy didn't buy those eggs for intent on, these eggs will probably taste better. That's why I bought these eggs, because I believe these eggs will taste better. Like that default to a negative mindset. And when somebody would bring up somebody's name, the first stories that would come out would be bad stories. Oh, I heard this about that person. Oh, I know this person did that. I know. And it was like, where's the default to the good, right? Where do we owe these people credit for things they've done? And we seem to have lost that in the fire service. How quickly a rumor, right? Tell a friend, tell the mailman, tell a fireman, whatever the saying is. Like, how quickly bad rumor and to the point of slander and defamation. Like, it is full on slander and defamation that gets ripped around these fire halls with no fact, no context, no backstory, no truth seeking whatsoever. Because that's the default thing to do and the accepted thing to do. It just goes back to losing that common courtesy of, like I say, kind of that, like that handshake, that wave, the courtesy wave. we don't give ourselves that pause to just appreciate the small action. We go straight for looking for the negative.
And it makes me think of also how it takes a lot of good calls, as in ones you're able to frame in your mind as being good, that you did well and it went well and you feel good about it, to counterbalance just a few bad calls. Like the ones that really bother you, it takes a lot of perspective for the good of your job and the good that you've done, and holding on to those and celebrating the wins to sort of counterbalance a very few difficult calls. So if you're always focused on the negative and you're pulling the negative out of everything, then a lot of calls will be bad, negative. The balance is off, right? You have to celebrate the wins and focus on the good to counterbalance and maintain and sustain yourself in the job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just don't think we talk enough about those little things like, hey, did you guys notice the new guy swept the bay floors today? Like, it's just expected. Well, yeah, it is expected. I agree, it's expected. But hey, they did it. Let's celebrate that fact. Hey, a senior man did something. Like, that's awesome. The senior man doesn't have to do that. But he did, because he should. In all reality, he should. But he doesn't have to. So let's celebrate that fact. Let's celebrate those things that we take for granted. And it's like, yeah, that car should stop for you at the crosswalk. Absolutely, it should. That is the luck. It doesn't have to. It's going to win. It's going to win, not us. So the courtesy wave. So what if they don't wave back? It'd be great if they did. But just those simple little things that just, I don't know, we seem to have lost. It's weird. It's weird where we've gone. And I don't know if it's from 2 years of isolation from each other that really sped that along, but I feel like we were headed that way before then too. I think where that leaks over into the fire service, like I say, is that we're so keen to jump on the negative, especially with each other, that it's unfortunate, because as we started this chat today, is like, we started it because there is so many amazing people in the fire service doing such awesome things. And why we're not focusing on that. And all those guys I mentioned, I guarantee you, in their fire halls, there's all sorts of slagging going on. I guarantee it. And I shouldn't be able to guarantee it. And that's the sad thing.
Maybe as long as there's balance in the right, like in the right ratio, we're okay.
Yeah. And I'm sure they've pissed in somebody's cereal. Absolutely. But whatever, you can't make everyone happy. But again, appreciating the fact that, like, that might be a guy you work with every day, and he might have been a recruit that you knew that did something stupid when you were in your 20s, because guess what? He was in his 20s and he did something stupid. We all make mistakes. But why focus on that mistake from when he was in his 20s, when he's now in his 40s doing so many great things? And at the coffee table, his name comes up and you go, oh yeah, I remember 20 years ago when we finished up that recruit class and we went out and they did this. And it's like, oh yeah, but how about all the awesome things they did in the last 12 months? Like, right? We don't have to constantly default to the bad story.
Right. How are people going to reach out to you and connect if they want? If they got questions, or?
www.prepare4.ca is our website. Nathan@prepare4.ca is the best email for me. It's probably the best way to get a hold of me. We're on social media as well. Facebook and Instagram. Went up to the UConn for the first time this year teaching. That was pretty cool.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was fun. Went up with the Fire Chiefs Convention up there and presented up there. So it was good.
We actually, at SFA, we have a group coming over from South Korea for RIT.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So I'm super stoked to be doing a couple of days there.
Yeah, that'll be cool, man. I look forward to hearing about that. That'll be cool.
I'm excited to see how many things are the same. Like, I did the work exchange in New Zealand, so I already sort of have some experience of, like, a lot of things are the same all over the world. And then I remember hearing back from one of the recent weekly scraps, the guy from Training Seconds, his name's escaping me, Ron, I believe is his first name. They did the Elkhart Brass. He was one of the guys who went over with Elkhart and did the UK.
Oh, yeah, that looked like an amazing experience.
Yeah, yeah. And he was talking about how, as much as a few things are different, everything's the same. So I'm really interested to, like, to connect with this group, with what we have in common in the fire service.
My late father-in-law, He set up for me one time when we went over for England, unbeknownst to me, but he actually set up an exchange for me with the local fire station in Grantham in the United States, or United Kingdom, sorry. Yeah, the high pressure systems and not having fire hydrants and how they do all that is absolutely very different. But the amount of similarities in the day to day and approaches of the day to day, besides, there literally wasn't coffee time. The junior person had to go make tea and brought it up on a tray with biscuits to the TV room, which was just fantastic with the kettle and everything. It was all, oh, it's just perfect. Like you say, there's, for all the differences, there's probably two similarities to every difference.
Awesome. And yeah, well, we'll connect after I do that class. I'll let you know about it.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's good to chat to you today.
You too, always.